welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and there is a great new four-part documentary on Netflix called The Sons of Sam, produced and directed by Talk is Jericho alumni Joshua Zeman. He is behind the Murder Mountain and Cropsey documentaries. He was on Talk is Jericho to discuss both, along with Urban Legends. Josh is back on Talk is Jericho today to take us behind the scenes of his latest documentary series. It's a huge hit. It's been top 10 ever since it came out a few weeks ago. It's talking about the Son of Sam serial killings that terrorized New York City between the summer of 1976 and July of 1977. Josh actually tells a story about investigative journalist Maury Terry, who never believed that the Son of Sam killer David Berkowitz acted alone in killing six people and wounding seven others. Terry spent years doing his own investigation into Berkowitz and the crimes and turned over his case file to Josh for the documentary. So Josh went deeper down Maury's rabbit hole, which included satanic panic in the 80s, cults, a connection to Charles Manson even, and also explains why New York City police were never interested in exploring the possibility that Berkowitz did not act alone or pursue other suspects. This is a fascinating look into Maury Terry's investigation and the toll it took on him. He basically gave his life for it. And the state of New York City at the time of the murders and how it affected everyday life and the culture. Like I said, the four-part series Sons of Sam is available on Netflix right now, narrated by award-winning actor Paul Giamatti.
Paul was really great. I had worked with him on a film a number of years ago, and when I approached him, he was totally gung-ho to do it. He's totally into fun and weird stuff and loves everything true crime, and so he actually hadn't known about the subject matter, but we kind of talked about it, and I thought he just did a wonderful job of kind of, you know, really getting Maury's style and intonations, and so couldn't be happier with that.
All right, Josh is back to give us more insight into his Sons of Sam documentary, what inspired him to tell Maury's story, and you can find out even more information about Josh's discoveries on Searching for the Sons of Sam, the podcast that Josh has just started a few weeks ago. You can get that wherever you hear all of your podcasts, including Talk is Jericho, every Wednesday and Friday. Go down the rabbit hole with Josh Zeman twice a week, but go down it even further right here on Talk is Jericho. And the conversation starts now. So one of my favorite documentary filmmakers is Josh Zeman, and you've been on, this is actually your third time here on Talk is Jericho, obviously to discuss Sons of Sam, which is pretty much the hottest new documentary in America today. And you were on before to discuss Murder Mountain, which was amazing, and then of course Killer Legends / Cropsey, discussing Urban Legends. You keep finding these really cool, strange yet very accessible topics that everybody knows about, but no one really thinks about making a movie about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like my own little Marvel universe. You know, I had done Cropsey, and while making Cropsey, I kept hearing these weird rumors that somehow the kids in Cropsey were related to the Son of Sam and maybe had been taken by a cult that was related to the Son of Sam. And I was like, what the hell are you guys talking about? I thought it was all satanic panic. And the cops were like, no, there's actually some truth to this. Sit down. Let me tell you a story. And they were like, we've worked on a number of cases. Some of us have worked on the Son of Sam case. And we actually believe there was much more than the NYPD, you know, the New York Police Department, let us talk about publicly. And they said, go read this book called The Ultimate Evil by Maury Terry. I read it. It scared the shit out of me. I don't scare easy.
Right.
And I was like, okay, I got to go check this guy, Maury Terry, out. I met him. He was like on an oxygen mask in his house in Yonkers. And he was a full-blown conspiracy nut. But his stuff about the Son of Sam was like real and good. And I started to call up all these other cops and like really checked out the story. And he checked out and his story checked out. I had been doing another show called The Killing Season about Long Island. And I got word that Maury Terry had passed away. And I was like, what am I going to do now? And suddenly a couple months later, I got three boxes, all his files.
What?
And I was like, yeah. And I was like, wow, I'm going to make this documentary about him.
First of all, just so people that don't know, Cropsey was based on kind of an urban legend of someone that might actually have been a real killer, but it was kind of all in that New York, Long Island area.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Basically, it was like this urban legend we had growing up about, well, basically Cropsey is an urban legend that's in sleepaway camps in upstate New York. And it's kind of like all the same. It's about a guy, usually like a caretaker or like some judge or somebody whose wife gets killed by a bunch of campers lighting matches and the forest burns down. And somehow that made its way down to Staten Island and got like hooked in to this Willowbrook mental institution. And it became this like other child snatching story that actually turned out to be real.
Right. So that's kind of the background to lead you to where you're talking about with the Sons of Sam. And there's so much to talk about, but so who sent you this box of information about Maury Terry?
Maury Terry's family. Basically he died and he like sent me, you know, his family, he told his family to send me his case files. And so.
So he knew about you and the documentaries you had done, or did he know that you were starting to sniff around the Sons of Sam idea?
No, like when Cropsey was being made, you know, and the cops were like, no, this story's real. They said, go read Maury Terry's book. I read Maury Terry's book. I went to visit him in his house and he's like, I saw Cropsey. I really liked it. Do something about the Son of Sam. And I didn't know if this guy was nuts or not. I didn't know if he was a total conspiracy nut, but he checked out. But I didn't really want to make a documentary about him. He was too close to the story. He was too nutso. But only when he passed away and sent me his case files was I like, okay, you know, I can make a documentary.
It's interesting too, Josh. Like, obviously, you and I have a personal relationship, and you're always, like I said, always finding these really cool documentary subjects. But it seems like the Son of Sam, especially now, I find after the pandemic started, we've been doing this for a year. Everyone, like I have watched Ramirez and Henry Lee Lucas and Bundy and Gacy. So when I see the Berkowitz, I'm like, I've kind of seen enough about Berkowitz. But because it's you, I watch. And now, of course, obviously, it's just tremendous about. It's actually a common theme if you watch any of these movies about how sometimes the police don't want to know the truth because they just want the arrests. But to kind of delve into a Son of Sam David Berkowitz story, I can see why you might be a little bit reticent about it at first because it's kind of been, you know, it's kind of trodden territory, shall we say.
I mean, people think that they know what the story is.
But yeah, not this one.
Yeah, I mean, they think they know it's about a guy who shot couples in lovers' lanes. I mean, David Berkowitz is like the original story. Like, if you watch movies, it all came from this. Like, the letters and the demon dog and the shooting couples in lovers' lanes. Like, this is where, like, all movie tropes came from. Mm-hmm. And people think that they know this story, but that's the whole thing. They don't. Not this story. This is a total different whole ball of wax.
So when Maury Terry's family sends you all of this stuff, what are you finding in here that really makes you go, holy shit, we've got something?
It was the level of his files. Like I would pull out a file and I would look at it and they'd be like, Bob, devil worshiper, killed this, killed that. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then there were all these tapes that he had of conversations that he recorded with David Berkowitz.
Yeah.
With people like, and I'm, when I say recorded, I'm talking like press play and put the phone up to the speaker on that time. Like, this is like 1980s.
This is not high quality material here.
No, this is 1980s mixtape off the radio type of shit. You know what I'm saying? So it just has that feel and it's so authentic and it's like, okay, you know, this guy's recorded enough stuff about his life. He saved all the times that he was on the radio. He was on enough programs and he's talking about devil worshiping and Son of Sam being part of a cult. I'm in.
So let's kind of go back then, because the original story, like you mentioned, and if you're into the true crime aspect, which a lot of listeners on our show are Berkowitz, 77, 76, whatever it was, 13 people get shot, 6 die. And then they finally catch the Son of Sam, who is David Berkowitz. And that's kind of the way that the story goes. That's the way that everybody knows the story. And that's just it, done, signed, sealed, delivered. But what we're seeing in your movie is that's not necessarily the case. So where do you start with a story like this, which is pretty much boiled into the fibers of America, of Americana at this point in time?
I mean, look, you have to tell the story first about this incredible time in New York City.
Yeah.
As you said, it's 76, 77. New York City had just been on the brink of bankruptcy. The crime rate is 4 murders a night.
Wow.
Basically, there's no social services, right? So there's no garbage. There's garbage strikes. Garbage is piling up. Disco is everywhere. Punk scene is just happening. There's all these arsons that are going on in the Bronx. So the Bronx is burning. You've got the 1977 New York Yankees. You've got a blackout, an incredible blackout where like millions and millions of dollars of damage are happening. And all through this, through 13 months, you've got this guy, the son of Sam, basically shooting couples in cars in Lover's Lane. People are terrified. You have girls cutting their hair. Couples aren't even going out. The streets are empty. They're not going to restaurants, bars, and discos. Everybody's completely afraid. So you tell that story of that investigation, these letters that had been sent to both the police dropped at the scene and sent to New York Daily News columnist Jimmy Breslin. The letters start like the line is, "Hello from the gutters of New York City." I mean, what kind of line is that? That's unbelievable. That's like a movie.
That's a letter that's written by the killer to the police. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and it's like these letters are unbelievable. And so, you know, there's this, we tell the story of theoretically the police investigation, what they did. And, you know, they really try and find this guy and finally, theoretically, through a parking ticket that's been given around one of the crime scenes. They do some research and find that that parking ticket leads them back to this guy, David Berkowitz. They go up to his house, look in his car, and there's just so happens to be a letter and a machine gun in the back of his car, and they catch the son of Sam. He gets paraded in front of all these people. He's smiling, this weird smile, and he says, "I did it. More so, I was commanded by a demon dog to do it." His neighbor's dog, theoretically, that was speaking to him. That's actually a 6,000-year-old being named Sam. And the dog commanded me to kill and shoot all these couples. And that's it. He gives good evidence. He knows details about the case. And they say, okay, you know, you obviously did it. You know, you're crazy. Right. Sign, seal, delivered, lock him up, and that's it. He gets 400 years.
Really?
Yeah. And the nightmare is over, except for this one journalist named Maury Terry from Yonkers, New York, who happens to be around the same neighborhood where Berkowitz is arrested. And he starts to like really weirdly question the investigation. He starts to go back and look at all the details. He looks at all these vehicles that the cops had been looking at. He looks at all these sketches that weirdly don't look anything like Berkowitz, you know, and you can't really rely on sketches, but like these sketches are weird because like two people would sketch the exact same person, but that doesn't look anything like David Berkowitz. So there's all this. He even finds clues in the letters. Like he finds like word association maps and stuff, just all this weird stuff. But probably the biggest thing is that he finds these two neighbors of David Berkowitz, Michael Carr and John Carr, who happen to be friends with Berkowitz. And they also happen to be the sons of that guy, Sam Carr, who owned the dog. They are the literal sons of Sam.
Sons of Sam.
So this is how it happens. And it's a crazy story, but it's kind of true.
Well, you know, just to kind of jump in here, Josh, it's funny, too, because I thought it was interesting that it was John Wheat Carr. And then his sister was Wheat Carr.
Yeah.
They have the same f***ing name. Like, what the hell's going on in the car house?
I think what happened was, it's funny. I think what happened was her name is Wheat Carr. And I think there was a joke between the boy and the kid, the brother and friends. They gave him the nickname of the sister. Like, oh, you like to eat Wheaties, huh? You know, they like were around with him and like, you know,
right.
did like that. And so he gets the nickname,
the wheat
John car. Wheat Carr. Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting and it's so relatable to what's going on now. And especially last year, 2020 in 1977, where, like we said, New York City, what is there? 30 million people in the city, let's say,
mm-hmm.
give or take. But you're talking about the whole city is in terror, kind of almost like to an extent like a coronavirus thing or even like a vaccine thing where I don't want to take a vaccine because I remember that when the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, there was blood clots, for example, and there were 7 people that died of blood clots out of 7 million people that took it, which is literally 1 in a million, right? So when I see this back in 77, it's like this type of mania goes on. It doesn't matter what generation it is. People were terrified to go out in New York City because there was a 1 in a million chance that the Son of Sam was going to shoot you. And one of the things that really got me was there was a father. And once again, all of these things resonate so much more when you have kids. I don't know if you have kids or not, but I do now. So when the father is crying and saying, like, I said, please don't go to Brooklyn. Or I'm probably getting this wrong. He said, okay, Dad, I'll just stay in Queens. And then the kid gets shot in Queens. As a parent, you're like, that's on you for the rest of your life. So I can understand this whole city in panic. Like you said, New York City just being in shambles already. And then throw in this serial killer who does kill 6 people. But those 6 parents are multiplied by 6 million parents in that area where this all happened.
You're totally right. I mean, the chances of getting shot by the Summer Sam are so low comparatively. Right. Like, people were getting shot. 4 people were dying a night in New York.
Right, 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 right.
But, you know, it's the idea that it's random. You know, that's one of the things. It's like you could be anywhere and he's going to come up and get you. And look, New York City hadn't had like this kind of serial killer, weirdly enough. Like, no. They hadn't had it. You know, Bundy, everybody else had Bundy. They had Gacy. They had the Zodiac. But New York City didn't really have this. And so this was kind of like new for them. And it was just a very weird time as well. It was a pretty depraved time. I mean, you had a lot of murder, you had a lot of drugs, you had a lot of crime, you know, disco and punk rock. It was sex, drugs, and rock and roll in New York City in 1977. Like, it was going on. I talked to these people and I'm like, well, can you tell me what it was like back then? And they're like, it was like the pandemic.
Wow. Right.
People weren't going out. People were freaked out. People were staying at home. People were having house parties at home because they didn't want to go out. Kids weren't having sex. Like, the whole generation of kids who were going fool around in cars weren't going out and doing that in New York City. So they were freaking out.
So when Berkowitz gets arrested and he even says, you know, I am the Son of Sam, you caught me, basically turns himself in once they find out. Where does Maury Terry start putting together that there's more than meets the eye to this whole situation?
Good question. So it's a couple of things. Number one, Berkowitz gets arrested like just around the corner from where Maury lives. And Maury is a frustrated investigative reporter. He had been an investigative reporter and then he like got frustrated. He left and now he's working for IBM. He's writing like their in-house magazine. So he wants to go on a mission, you know? And here's the interesting thing. There had been some grumblings around speaking to people that, like, you know what? First, he doesn't look like the sketches. Like, he looks nothing like these sketches. And everybody was kind of like, yeah, you know, but sketches aren't reliable. And then they're like, yeah, I know, but, you know, these 2 women both sketch this one guy exactly. And, like, neither of them look like this guy. Or
they weren't even close. They weren't even close.
They weren't, you know, and they sketched the same looking guy, except one had one hair part on the right side and the other one had the hair part on the other side. So, like, you know, this is a good sketch because both girls sketched the exact same guy. So the sketches don't add up. And if you like read the newspaper reports, the police had been looking for a VW bug all over the place, like leading up to the crimes. And suddenly Berkowitz gets arrested and everybody's like, well, where's this VW that's been seen in all these crimes? And it's the police just ignore it as well. Berkowitz had also been committing like some crimes up in Yonkers as well, and police didn't pick up on that either. And then Maury's like one of those guys. You know how you have friends who like they can recall everybody's batting average.
Yeah, right.
You know, from like 1983 Brewers. Course, you know, you're like, how do you know that? You know, right. So he's a little bit on the spectrum, and so he like plays word games, and he notices like weird word games in the letters. Then, probably one of the most interesting things is he sees this alias that the Son of Sam writes in one of the letters. He's like, let me give you some help. Look at these people. One of them is John Wheaties, rapist and suffocator of young girls. Well, Maury is just doing some investigative work. He's like, well, let me call the Carr family and ask them about this Berkowitz. He goes into the phone book and he's looking, oh, Sam Carr. And he looks underneath, and right underneath Sam Carr's name, it says John Wheaties Carr. And he's like, wait a second, that's the same name that's in the letter. You know, and he's like, did the police not see this? Did anybody look at this guy's name in the phone book? And they didn't. In fact, the police spent tens of thousands of man hours going down every single rabbit hole, looking at every single clue. For example, somebody writes the Wicker, they use the word Wicked King Wicker. They go and arrange a screening of the Wicker Man because they're going down everything. Yeah, they did everything. But they didn't spend 1 hour interviewing Sam Carr and the son, the actual sons of Sam, the guys who were the sons of Sam, who happened to be friends with Berkowitz. They didn't interview them at all. If they did, they would know that he looks exactly like the sketch. So it was a little bit of the police not really kind of doing everything that they needed to do. And Maury being a kind of a smart guy, a kind of genius, you know, when it comes to this stuff. And then from there, he just started to delve into the case and find out that the Carr brothers were a bunch of weird kids and they had like all these satanic connections, and that a bunch of people were hanging out in Untermyer Park, like the local park. And it just got weird from there.
You know, it really is such a strange situation, and that you can see, you know, and God bless Maury Terry. When you, as we get forward on, we'll talk about going on all these talk shows and talking about the evidence. And we saw this on the Henry Lee Lucas show, and we saw this on the John Wayne Gacy show. Like, the police just wanted it wrapped up, tied up in a bow, and it's Berkowitz, and don't f with it.
Yeah.
Even if you're not right, we don't want to hear it. And to me, that's where it gets scary, because when, you know, I fought the law and the law won, when the law decides a certain, you know, way to go, like Maury Terry lived to his final days knowing that he could be right, but no one was listening to him. Did that frustrate you as well when you were kind of looking into this and even interviewing a lot of the guys who were in their 70s or what, maybe even 80s now, going, he was wrong. There was only one guy. There's no way there could be more than one, and not even entertaining the possibility.
It's like arguing with your grandfather.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
It's like, okay, but think about this. He's like, ah, shut up. You know, he's like, I don't even want to hear about it.
That's right.
You know, and it's like, you're not going to argue with your grandfather because, you know, it's a losing proposition. You know what I'm saying? It's right. Like, oh, exactly. There is no way I'm going to go there, you know? And so it was frustrating. The other thing is also, like, when you watch it, you realize, like, David Berkowitz was kind of like a sacrificial lamb.
Yeah.
So that New York City could get back on its feet. Like, let's say, for example, that there was a dude who walked up and said, look, I could get rid of the whole pandemic right now. Right. Just me. Right. If I admit it and this gets rid of the pandemic, you would be like, absolutely. I don't care if you're guilty or not.
Right.
You know,
right.
We got to get back with our lives. And so it's kind of like that. You know, this dude, you know, plus he gave this like crazy story. And so everybody was like, yep, he did it. And then the press was like, whew, thank God. The mayor, who was losing at the time in the polls, like, he wanted this thing over. New York City was losing so much money. And, you know, Maury's at times, Maury was like, I don't understand how they didn't do this work. And I'm like, Maury, like, it's Chinatown, Jack. What are you talking to me? Like, how they didn't do this work? Like, they needed this to be over. You know, people were freaking out 13 months. So it was frustrating for Maury. Maury said that the only thing he ever wanted was the police to admit that they were wrong.
That's hard to get, though, man.
You're never going to get. No way. Like, the police are, especially in New York City, like, they are not going to admit that. And especially in 1970s. Another thing is that one of the victims said to me, Josh, I love the fact that you're doing this story, but what do you think is going to change versus all the times that Maury Terry tried to do this? And I said, you know what? I think our relationship with the police has changed a little bit since then. Mm-hmm. We're not so like, it's not so the good guys always wear white hats.
Right.
And you know, the right. bad guys always wear black hats. Like it's that day is over. You know, we know that, you know, we watch The Wire. We know that things are complicated. You know, we watch a lot of cop shows.
Watch the news. I mean, God's sake.
Right. Wow. Exactly. You know, we know that these investigations are complicated, and we know that, you know, politics comes into play, and we know, you know, that it's never so easy as a demon dog told me to do it. Like that wouldn't fly today. You got to be kidding.
You know, it's interesting. I love watching. And once again, I could ask you a million questions about how you got all this footage and all that stuff. But that's
a documentary
thing. But just watching Mayor Abe Beame, who my connection to the 70s and all the political topics growing up in Winnipeg, Canada, and then you're going to laugh at this, was Cracked Magazine and Mad Magazine.
Cracked right? Magazine.
Because they were very political and very much all into this. I knew the name David Berkowitz when I was like 9 years old because he was in Cracked and Mad. And seeing Mayor Abe Beame and just how short he was.
Yeah. Yeah.
I had to go Google. He was 5'2" because here's this. Yeah. Here's this guy. Like Rey Mysterio is 5'4". So here's this guy who's running New York City. And when they show close ups of him, he looks like a badass dude. And then you see him and then the cop comes to get his accolade. And it's like this munchkin. And I'm not cutting him down, but it's like, oh, my gosh.
No.
I never realized how short he was to be in that power position.
He was an accountant. I mean, they hired him because he was an accountant because New York City was bankrupt. And when you bankrupt. Say New York City has gone bankrupt, like that's not a good thing. Like you can't pay the police, you can't pay the teachers, you can't garbage. Pay the garbage yeah. men, you know, like that's problematic, you know? Right. And so they hire this dude to come in and get New York City out of bankruptcy. And this guy is just getting his ass kicked. You know, he's got he's got a blackout where people are rioting. He's got bombings. He's got everything. And then, you know, then finally the Son of Sam comes in. He's smiling for the camera and he's like, you got me.
We got him. Yeah.
And he's like, oh, please. Thank you. Thank you. Please. We needed you. We needed you.
Thank you, Mr. Son of Sam. Right.
Totally. David Burke goes, I love you. You know? and so that's what happened.
So when does it suddenly switch over to this whole satanic cult thing? And one of the things that I text you about as I was watching the show is, I don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole, but in the 80s, satanic panic, as you called it, I was in the midst of it. And I can't believe when you talked about Dungeons and Dragons that Iron Maiden and Black Sabbath and Motley Crue weren't brought up as well. Because all of that stuff was Satanism in like 83 to 88 was like gold.
It was the jam.
It was. So let's not get too far ahead of us. How did that get from Berkowitz to Maury Terry to this satanic panic that happened only 4 or 5 years after Berkowitz's arrest?
I mean, that's a good question. So
I ask a lot of good questions, man.
No, that's a good one because Berkowitz is writing these letters, or theoretically somebody is writing these letters, and he's using a lot of like fairly like Beelzebub, real right. demonic terms.
And do you think Berkowitz wrote those letters? You said somebody.
I think Berkowitz wrote the first letter and the Carr brothers wrote the second letter.
Gotcha. Okay. So you think the Carr brothers are right involved? Gotcha. Okay.
Oh yeah. They're very different. Like the first letter looks like your typical like kid serial killer. You know, it says like, I am the Son of Sam with like a lot of exclamation points. It's kind of written in scrawl. Yeah. It's like underlined with like exclamation. There might as well be a heart, you know, on top of it, you know, and he's like, I did it. Pow, pow, pow. Mr. Monster, yours in blood. The second letter is like, Dear Jim, hello from the gutters of New York City. Like, it's totally different. The penmanship is so nicely drawn. In fact, it's so well drawn that the police went to Marvel and DC Comics to see if the writer had been a comic book illustrator.
Really?
A letter. Yeah.
Wow.
Ironically, what they didn't know is that in 1976, one of the Carr brothers, Michael Carr, had applied for a license, and it was for Carr Illustration Studios at his father's address. But they missed that one. So
okay.
Anyway, so how do we get satanic? So there's all these satanic references to the letter, and basically Maury, in his investigation, looks at the Carr brothers and starts to ask in like the underbelly of Yonkers what's going on.
Right.
And they're all like, oh yeah, Berkey and the Carr brothers and a whole bunch of people used to go hang out at this park called Untermyer Park, which is like a mile from their house. And it runs along the Hudson River. Underneath it is what's called the quote Croton Aqueduct, AKA all these tunnels that the kids used to call the gutters or the sewer. So when the opening letter starts, hello from the gutters of New York City, he's seeing like all these connections to all these areas around Yonkers. And basically this was at a time when people were saying that there was all this chanting going on down in Untermyer Park. And these kids were basically doing theoretically devil worshiping stuff. Now, I always thought it was satanic panic. I always thought it was bullshit. And I pushed Maury on that. And the cops are like, no, it was more than just kids with a kegger spray painting 666 and Iron Maiden stuff everywhere. Right. This was real. And I'm like, are you sure? And then they would start to give me evidence. And yeah, it actually was real. There actually was a group of people who were delving into this in a far more Dungeons and Dragons, you know, way than you and I would think of, like, satanic panic. Like, we know satanic panic. Like, I was one of those kids listening to Metallica over and over again on my Walkman, smoky pot and spray painting 666 everywhere. Like, I totally did that. But this is on a different level.
So when you start talking about all of this mania that happens, because the media is always looking for a good story. You know, don't let the truth get in the way of a good story. Did it – and we haven't even gotten to the Manson connection yet, but did it surprise you as a documentarian, obviously, was it a stretch for you to connect Berkowitz, Sons of Sam, with the Satanic Panic, or was it something that you really felt one led to another, which once again led to – I texted you today about Morton Downey Jr. I forgot about that guy. What a guy, like super loud mouth, you know, smoking cigarettes. But I remember him and Geraldo and Sally Jesse Raphael and Maury Povich going deep to these satanic teenage issues. Do you think that really was all connected to Berkowitz and the Sons of Sam?
So what happened was Berkowitz and the Son of, I mean, that's my whole thing, dude. I'd love to debunk satanic panic. I love to get in there and call bullshit on all of this.
Yeah.
What happens when you're in there and like you finally find a case that's somewhat real,
right?
That has real shit to it. Like, and that's the scenario. Like, I am the biggest debunker in the world. Like, if you see Cropsey, it's like, no, it's about pedophilia. Right. It's not about this and killer legends. It's debunking this stuff. But this is the one case where I actually found some like crazy truth behind it. And that's why I wanted to do it. Now, everybody's like, be careful. Maury Terry's a real satanic panic dude. And I was like, yes, but that almost makes it that much more interesting where you try and get into the mind of this dude. So when Maury Terry goes public with his story and says the police did not do a good job, they called Maury Terry a crackpot.
Mm-hmm. Big time.
Maury Terry doubles down. And he says, he's like, starts to really search for like the truth. And he goes way down the rabbit hole and he starts to bring up this satanic panic, this satanic stuff, which is actually in this case real, but nobody will listen to him except for the Geraldos, the Sally Jesse Raphaels, the Morton Downey Jr.'s and all those wackos. Why do they believe him? Because ironically, at the same time, satanic panic is sweeping across the nation. Mm-hmm. So Maury makes a deal with the devil. He decides that he is going to go on all these shows and tell them his real satanic stuff with Berkowitz so that he could spread the word. And the satanic panic people love him because finally they have a real case that they could like point to, right, rather than some disgruntled teenager who shot another, right, teenager.
Good point. A legendary case too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, like Ricky Casso, you know, it's like Ricky Casso, which is a famous Long Island case. They're like, oh, it's about satanic, you know, this. It's like, no, man, he killed somebody else over like three bags of PCP. Yeah. But like he said, say you love Satan. You know, it's like just, yeah, stupid shit, you know. So he makes a deal with the devil. He starts to go on all these TV shows. They listen to him. They put his story out there. But he also loses credibility with everybody else
because he's going on these sensationalistic shows.
Exactly. So gotcha. So he gets his story out there, but he loses credibility. And so by the end, you know, he's a broken man because he's lost all credibility because nobody would listen to him because they called him a crackpot.
Yeah.
And he doubled down. But then he became that much more of a crackpot. You know, when your parents say, don't make that face or you'll, you know, you'll be that way forever, or don't act crazy because you, yeah, might go crazy. You know, that's kind of, well, what happened.
It's a sad story in a lot of ways because, like, I find Maury Terry, and first of all, what a great name, you know, Maury Terry. It's easy to remember Maury Terry, but I feel like bad for him because, to me, I almost equate it like if you got put in jail for a crime you did not commit. I'm innocent. I'm telling you. Yeah, well, you got a point, but nah, we've already thrown the book at you. We're not going to go back. It's kind of similar to that, but he has so much evidence. And like he keeps saying, look at the evidence. Listen, we told you the son of Sam has been caught. It's Berkowitz. Shut your mouth and quit being a lunatic. And you feel bad for him because like you said, and even his ex-wife said, he becomes obsessed to a point to where his whole perspective is tainted by this crusade that he's going on. And when nobody really wants to listen, and he turns a lot of heads, but like you mentioned, he never gets the final push over the cliff that changes the course of time.
He even gets Berkowitz to admit that he didn't do it. But it's like, A, nobody's going to believe a serial killer. You know, the whole point of the doc is that one scene where Berkowitz writes him a letter and says, Maury, no matter how good your evidence, right, is, no one will ever truly believe you. The serial killer is, yeah, giving this guy, you know, the most concise, smart information. And that's the total truth. I mean, imagine you had the clues that could unlock and solve one of the greatest true crime mysteries in all of history. But nobody would believe you.
Yeah.
That would make you go mad.
Absolutely insane. You're exactly right. Exactly right.
And I'll give you a little example. I pitched this story for about 10 years and no one would buy it. And I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Mm-hmm. This is a great idea. This has got everything. You know, it's got serial killers. It's got cults. It's got New York City in 1977.
Right, right, right.
Like, what more, you know, orgies in Long Island? Like, what do you want? You know, and I couldn't sell it. So I was like, I started to like get nuts. I'm like, what is it? You know, like, why can't I sell this goddamn story? And so I felt like Maury. You know, I'm sitting there smoking cigarettes time, like Maury is. I'm like, why can't they? You know, I was like, these motherfuckers won't take this show. There must be some kind of conspiracy, you know? And so, like, I felt that.
And don't forget to check out Searching for the Sons of Sam, Josh's bi-weekly podcast every Wednesday and Friday. You can listen to it anywhere you listen to podcasts. He goes deeper down the rabbit hole talking about his documentary and the circumstances behind it. The Sons of Sam, it's on Netflix now. And we go back to Josh Zeman right here on Talk is Jericho. Let's go back to, I just had a great show a few weeks ago with Stephanie Harlow talking about the kind of the intricacies of the Manson family. Where did you find the connection with Berkowitz and Charles Manson?
So Maury believed, and this is through the name that you might know, Ed Sanders. You know, Ed Sanders writes the definitive book on Manson called The Family, right?
Right.
And in it, Ed Sanders basically figures out that Manson got his helter-skelter prophecy from another religious group called The Process, The Process Church of the Final Judgment, that he hooked up with in San Francisco in the hate, right when everything was going on in 66, 67. And it just so happens that David Berkowitz was also connected with the Church of the Process. And it's basically Ed Sanders, who's like the definitive conspiracy smart guy about Manson, and Maury Terry, who's the definitive smart guy about, you know, Berkowitz. They kind of hook up and they kind of come to this whole idea. And it's actually kind of interesting. You know, for those of you who don't know, the Process Church of the Final Judgment starts in London in the late 1960s. And they are basically two excommunicated Scientologists named Marianne de Grimston and Robert de Grimston. They get kicked out of Scientology by L. Ron Hubbard. They get excommunicated.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And they decide they're going to start their own kind of like psychoanalytic therapy organization. And it turns into a little bit of a commune. And this is in London. They start to get a whole bunch of rich guys and they kind of all get together. It turns into a bit of a commune. Then de Grimston starts to go down a little bit of a satanic path and starts to get really crazy with it and basically comes up with the idea. And this is not so crazy. He says, to really understand humanity, you have to embrace both good and evil that's inside all of us. And that kind of makes sense. You know what I'm saying? Catholicism, Catholics, they just deny that you have anything bad, you know, that you have ill thoughts or whatever. And so he says, no, we got to embrace both of it. And but then they start to go really down the deep end and they get into like Satanism. They get called the Mindbenders of Mayfair. They get called these occultists and they get kicked out of the UK. And then they start these cells that go all over the United States, Toronto, New Orleans, New York, LA, San Francisco. And one of their big hubs is San Francisco. They're hooked up with the Flower Kids and they're in the Haight-Ashbury. And that's where theoretically they meet Charles Manson. Charles Manson hangs out with them. He hangs out with a bunch of guys coming out of prison, but he hangs out with the Process. He hangs out with a whole bunch of others. And suddenly, a couple weeks later, he starts his own cult called The Family. He goes down to L.A. and, you know, where he said he hooks up again with the Process. The Process is also theoretically connected to RFK's assassination. The Process goes underground and then they appear suddenly in the early 1970s in New York City. Now, Maury Terry says that somehow the Process is connected to Berkowitz. And I'm not 100% sure that that is exactly true, but new stuff is coming up every day. And we actually find some really interesting connections. I spoke to a guy who worked in an occult shop in New York City called The Magical Child. And I was like, Maury Terry made all these wacko connections about the Process. He's like, actually, no. The Process, when we were all hanging out in occult shops, the Process were the people that we were afraid of. Like they were weird. They had these German shepherds. So I was like, and he's like, so when we started to hear that, like the Son of Sam thing happened, we all knew it was an occult crime because we had been hearing rumors. And then when we heard that dogs were getting sacrificed, like we found that to be pretty interesting. And we all internally thought it was the Process. And I was like, oh, that's very interesting. So that's brand new. That didn't come out in our documentary at all.
Wow. So, once again, there's so many ties, and that's what I love about how you told this whole story about, you know, this, it ties into the Manson family and ties into the Satanic Panic. And once again, it's like you find a kernel of one that relates to the other, and suddenly you've got a whole story.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting parts of the whole documentary to me is when Maury Terry finally meets David Berkowitz. And there's a great quote from one of the cats, the Australian guy, I can't recall his name, who says it's almost like Sherlock Holmes meeting his Moriarty.
Yeah.
Tell us about how that kind of happened. How was he able to work his way up to finally getting to this, you know, ultimate goal of getting to talk to the guy that he's been writing books about, et cetera, et cetera?
So first of all, that guy, Wayne Darwin.
Yes, that's the guy.
That dude is the supposedly where Robert Downey Jr.'s Australian character in Natural Born Killers comes from.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah,
the guy talks like this and he's like Nick and Mallory, you know, so it's that dude.
Good call.
Okay? See, Wayne Darwin, and he's crazy. He's a great dude. So what happens is Maury is having these long exchanges back and forth with Berkowitz. And he's always trying to get Berkowitz to kind of tell him the truth. And they have this crazy letter writing exchange. And then like he and Berkowitz, basically Maury kind of get into Berkowitz shuts down, you know, and it's always like trying to get Berkowitz, like the kitten out from under the couch. Like, right. Tell me this, tell me that, you know? So what happened was there is a cop named New York City cop named Marcus Quinones, who is an occult cop. He is Christian, but he's an occult cop, and he goes to all these different prisons and kind of speaks to people, and he becomes friends with David Berkowitz, and he also becomes friends with Maury Terry. And he says to David Berkowitz, David, my friend Maury would like to meet you. David's like, oh, Maury Terry, the guy who used to write me. And he's like, yes. And so Marcus Quinones basically arranged for the two to meet. Maury goes, Maury talks to him and basically convinces Berkowitz that after 16 years, they're going to finally talk and Berkowitz is going to do his first taped interview.
Right.
It was a huge deal.
Sure.
And basically that's how the two got to meet.
No, I know it was a huge deal, but so the point is when he gets a chance to actually talk to him, let's talk about kind of what some of the results were. Especially there's a lot of differences between I believe at least in the documentary there was two times that Berkowitz and Maury spoke. Let's talk about what happened in episode 1, shall we say? And the differences that went down in episode 2. And how far were those interviews between each other, by the way?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. 1993 and 1997. Right. So basically, it's always trying to like squeeze information out of Berkowitz. And some people think that Berkowitz is playing games, like it's a cat and mouse thing, like this, like basically it's a Mindhunter, right? Some people are like, this is Mindhunter, right? And basically, the first time Maury gets Berkowitz to admit that he didn't act alone. Now, that's huge. That is like a bombshell. Like what? New York City? You know, they had been believing for 16 years at Berkowitz, you know, the demon dog story. And he's like, no, I didn't act alone. But he's still being cagey. And he's saying, you know, I had some accomplices. And he names John Carr and Michael Carr. Now, it's very easy to name those two dudes because those two dudes happen to be dead because they died in really weird, mysterious circumstances, you know, like literally a year and 18 months after this thing happened. The crimes originally happened, like suddenly the guys who like people were like, I think they're involved. They suddenly die.
Well, and what kind of that would say is that if you believe they're a part of an overall conspiracy, satanic cult, whatever, once they get into the position where they could actually talk and tell some stories, they get murdered in mysterious auto accidents, etc.
And by the way, and that shit is true. You know what I'm saying? Like, like suddenly, if we want to reverse back a little bit, you know, basically, in the months after the investigation, you know, Maury Terry says, you guys need to look at this guy, John Carr. Like, you never looked at him. And people start to be like, John Carr. And they start to look and say, oh, he looks like this. Suddenly, they find out that John Carr shoots himself in the head with a shotgun, basically months after. And then John Carr has a brother, Michael Carr, who mysteriously dies in a car accident on the West Side Highway going like 100 miles an hour.
Too much. Right?
It is a little bit too much. And that's the thing about Maury. And like, you knew he was kind of on to something because everybody he looks into suddenly dies. And then you're like, okay, you're on the right track. So in this interview, Berkowitz admits, yes, Mike, John and Michael Carr, you know, they were shooters, but he won't say who the other shooters were, and he really won't say anything else. But that's still a win. It's a big win.
Yeah.
And you know, Wayne Darwin is super happy. You know, he's like a one of these reality producers. He's like, oh, this is going to be great, man. You know, and then suddenly it all blows up and the press starts to come back and they're like, bullshit. And the NYPD starts to say bullshit. And it just gets into a huge spat. But it was pretty big. I mean, this was a big thing. And they sold it to Inside Edition. And there you go. But Maury doesn't get what he really needs. He needs names. He needs the names of the other people. Because he needs, like, Berkowitz to come clean about everything. And so he hounds Berkowitz for, like, another 4 years. Like, come on, tell me the truth. Now, Berkowitz doesn't want to tell the truth for a number of reasons. One, his throat got slashed in prison years earlier.
Yeah, I saw that.
He got 50 stitches across his neck.
That was never really explained. Like, did that just happen or was he threatened or...
No, some guy, I mean, you know, 50 stitches across the neck is not like, oh, yeah. I accidentally shivved you. You know, 50 yeah. stitches across the neck is like, let me pull your head out, you know, your neck yeah. up and try.
You're
and
the split son of Sam. Here you yeah. go, buddy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So basically, and I have to agree with it, like that was a message to shut up. You
right.
know?
Right.
50 stitches across the front of your neck is a message to shut up. And this is like what smart cults do. Smart cults basically get your parents' information and say, we'll kill your family if you yeah. ever do this. You know, it's like what the Mexican cartels do, basically.
Right.
And so Berkowitz was adopted. So he's like super into his parents because he's adopted. So if they threaten to kill his father, like he does think it's going to happen. Like all his other buddies died. So he didn't want to talk for a long time. So finally his dad passes away. And during the, from the first to the second interview, and the second interview, he says he's going to come clean. Well, during that time, Maury had gone down like some serious rabbit holes. And, you know, he gets Berkowitz in there and he starts going after Berkowitz. Like, tell me this, tell me that. Maury starts to get a little like overly into like the children issue and the whole nine yards. And he kind of like just gets super aggressive in the interview and kind of screws it up because this is his moment.
Right.
This is his moment where he's going to finally prove to the world. And Berkowitz isn't giving him anything. Berkowitz is just like
mm-hmm. nothing. Yep. He's yes. And knowing him. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, Maury kind of got freaked because that was his moment. And, you know, he had built everything up, you know, he's going to yeah. finally prove to the world that he's right. And then suddenly Berkowitz doesn't say anything.
It almost seems like, and they say that, like that Maury was leading him into answers.
Mm-hmm.
And Berkowitz was playing along, but he's giving them nothing. It's like, would you say that when you walked down this street that you went to the first door instead of the left? Yes. Like there's nothing to it, right?
Well, look, I mean, that's the other thing. I mean, it's like, Berkowitz isn't a talker, you know, by definition, he's not really a talker. Well, you know, maybe a little bit, but like Berkowitz didn't want to go there. And I think Maury, not to defend Maury. Yeah, he was leading. Right. But at the same time, it's like if you get in that moment and your interviewee is going to clam up, like you are going to do,
of course,
you're going to do everything you can to get this guy to say anything.
And both of us have been there being, you know, your documentary. I'm a podcast host. I've been on the line with guests who's like, don't you understand the concept of a podcast is to talk?
Right.
Like you're giving me nothing here.
I mean, at that point, I'll just sit there until wear him down, you know, until like, you know, yeah. So we got for breakfast. I mean, you know, you want to elaborate on that?
In your opinion, why wasn't Berkowitz talking at that point? I mean, he knows why Maury's coming in.
Well, here's the thing. David Berkowitz is a patsy in every sense of the
sense
word.
Sense of the word. Gotcha.
Okay. He's a follower. You know, what I think in some ways it was with John and Michael Carr and the rest of the children and the group that he hung out with, I think it was like, Mikey likes it. You know, I think it was like, oh, give the gun to Berkey. Berkey will do it.
Right.
You know, like oh, you know, Berkey hasn't been laid. Like, he's kind of an incel. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like, Berkey hasn't had sex. Like, oh, you two girls go with Berkey in the corner. You know, now, hey, Berkey, you're going to go shoot this guy for us, right? Like, I think it was one of those jams, you know? And so Berkey has always been a follower. And so I think Maury kind of cajoled him into giving the interview. Right. You know, I think Maury wore him down. Like, come on, come on. And he's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know. And he's like, listen, you're going to help all these people. You need to help all these people. And remember, by the way, another interesting and important point is that Berkowitz had found religion.
Right.
So, you know, this is an opportunity for Berkowitz to spread the gospel that he knows about. And so I think if we're going to talk about like the gospel, Berkowitz is going to go off. But if it's going to talk to like, okay, so first you like lit a fire and then you did some incantations and then you went in and like slit her throat. Like if they're going to talk like that, he doesn't want to go there. So I happen to think Maury probably agreed and got Berkowitz and did the kind of religious part of the interview and then went to a lot of other stuff and Berkowitz wouldn't go there. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying?
Perfect sense. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe false pretenses.
As we start to wind down here, there's a couple of questions I want to ask you as a filmmaker. One, I guess the question I want to ask you, like, why did you make this? Did you make this because you wanted to expose the cult, or did you want to kind of put a spotlight on the legacy of Maury Terry and this work that was unfinished for him? Combination of the two?
Almost neither. I think I wanted to talk about how the media creates mythologies.
Right.
David Berkowitz and the demon dog.
Such a great point.
And I kind of wanted to rip that Band-Aid off and be like, come on. Like, you know, even the things that we think are so institutionalized stories may not be true. You know, like the biggest serial killer in New York City, the most famous case, you know, and even that may not be true. And so it's a way for us to question everything and start to really like use our heads, you know, about the stories that we're told, about what police narratives they are. And also, like, especially for someone who does true crime, I think we need cautionary tales about true crime as much as we need all these stories about true crime. Like, our obsessions aren't always healthy. I did it for me, dude, because I'm going down a lot of rabbit holes. Yeah. And I want to be able to pull myself out. And so in some ways, it's my own cautionary tale.
Which is kind of the true concept of art. You make art for yourself first and foremost, right? To satisfy and indulge your own creativity. But it's interesting to me because, like I said, after going through the ranks, the rabbit holes of all these different serial killers over the last year, Henry Lee Lucas just gave up to everybody. And you realize because the cops are like, listen, we can't figure out who killed Jim. Call Lucas. We got a conviction. Gacy. They would not believe the allegations against Gacy because he was putting on parades and he was part of the 4-H club or whatever the f*** it is. It's like all of these things that we see is that sometimes, and you know, we don't want to bag on the cops, but sometimes the cops don't want to go that far because, oh, come on. There's no way he would have done it. And I just felt that this case of the Sons of Sam really connected with me based on what we learned about the Gacy case and specifically the Henry Lee Lucas, where they weren't even looking at facts. They just wanted convictions.
Look, you know, it's Chinatown, Jack. You know, you got big cities, you got politics.
Great call.
You know, and you got, you know, people just want to go home at the end of the day. You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, it's, we actually have to take more care of our cops is the point. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In a different way. It's like, you don't give everybody free rein, you know, you pay them well, you know, you give the detectives, you know, good money so that they'll stay longer, so that they'll do more and you don't overload them with work. You know, you make it a good experience where like everybody respects each other, you know, and that's part of it. But like, you know, the politics, man, That's what you got. You know, politics run the world, you know, so you got to think about that.
Last couple of questions for you, Josh. In your opinion, what do you think, if you had to try and kind of encapsulate it, who were the real Sons of Sam? Who killed those people and shot the other seven in that summer of 77?
Berkowitz says it was five people.
Yeah, he admits to a handful of them.
And he admits to two of them.
Oh, so he says it's only five, not six?
No, six, five plus him.
Gotcha. Okay, gotcha.
So, and he admits to the first one, which is very interesting because they wanted him to pull the trigger at the first one because, you know, whatever you do after that, Berkey, you pull the trigger at the first one, you know, you started it.
It's your fault, right?
It's your fault, you know, and the sixth one where the first letter was dropped, you know, with theoretically his handwriting. And Berkowitz says that there were five other people. Two were the Carr brothers. This is what Berkowitz says. So this is may not be true. And this is both my opinion and just what Berkowitz says. The two Carr brothers and three other people. Whether he actually has the names of those three other people correct, I'm not so sure. We have a podcast called Searching for the Sons of Sam. Right. It's my first podcast. I was doing that as I'm doing this. And, you know, we go through and say who those at least who one of those other names are. So I think that's the closest we're ever going to get to knowing the truth behind this case. Did Berkowitz act alone? No, right. I really, really don't think so. And I think if you look at the evidence, the preponderance evidence, you'll see. Was there a cult? I don't know. Define a cult, you know, right. Define a Satan cult, you know, was there a bunch of dudes who got together who liked to do bad things and call themselves part of a group? I mean, it could have been a cult. It could have been a motorcycle gang. It's whatever you want to call yourselves at that day and that time, you know?
Right.
Does that make sense? You know,
it makes perfect sense. And that's the thing that I really enjoyed about watching this. And once again, there's so much to it, you know, A, possibility of a gang, B, calling them satanic cult or, you know, the cult of freaking Mickey Mantle, whatever the hell you want to say. But it, to me, it's just the posturing is not the right word. It's the need of the police to, and for the people as well. Let's be honest. If they would have said that we've caught the Son of Sam, but there's seven of the other of them, that city of New York in 78, 79 would have been just as scared.
Even more so, then their heads would have popped off.
Right. Then you're looking at every guy. Is he part of the cult? Is she part of the cult? It's almost like when you're talking about aliens in Area 51, it's almost like what you don't know is better than what you know. So if you can tag it on, pin the tail on the Berkowitz, and then just, it's almost like there's two sides to the story. There's our side, because I'll be with you, with Joshua, and with Maury Terry, that you want the truth. And there's also the other side, which I think a lot of these cops are involved with. They're going, just leave it, man. Just stop. Because if you continue down this rabbit hole, it's just going to cause mass hysteria. But damn it, we want the truth. But which one on the scales of justice is better?
You know, it was interesting. I spoke to an investigator who reopened the case. And the investigator tells me, he's like, oh my God. He's like, we went back in, they changed the police reports, they lied, there was such bad police, you know, policing. And I said, well, great, let's do an interview. He's like, right. Nah, what's the use? And the irony is like, dude, the original policing was bad, and you're going to tell me, you know, when you went back and looked at it, you saw how bad it was. The point is that if you tell us, then the first guys may not do it again.
Yeah.
You know, so it's changing those narratives after so many years is also really, really tough.
Yeah. Hard to change the, like you said, the attitude when the truth is not necessarily the truth at this point, you know?
It's all that movie, Who Shot Liberty Valance? You know, right. When Recall. The truth becomes, you know, print the legend, you know, when the truth become, you know, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. And that's what we're up against. And I wonder how much is that on all of these crime shows.
Last question for you, Josh. I'm a big, like I said, I'll watch anything by Kevin Smith. I'll watch anything by the Coen brothers and anything by Joshua Zeman. What other ideas, projects do you have in the chamber right now? Because they're always diverse of crazy topics, but they're always great.
At the moment, I'm going to take a little bit of a break. I do have a movie coming out in the summer about a whale. We went out to find this whale that calls out a frequency that no other whale can understand. It's called The Loneliest Whale. So we went out and looked for this whale. It's kind of like an Ahabian story.
That's cool.
So we have that coming out. And then we shall see what the next story is. It'll be, I think, let's see where true crime goes.
You have ideas.
I have ideas.
Let me ask you this, just from a production standpoint, how long did it take? Because this is about a 4-hour piece. There's four parts and they're all about an hour long. From soup to nuts, start, finish, how long did it take for you to make all this?
From the time that we got a green light to go?
Sure, or kernel of idea till now.
Kernel of idea, 12 years.
12 years, oh my gosh, wow.
From green light at Netflix to end, 16 to 18 months.
That's still a quick turnover, man. That's a quick turnover.
We were shooting right in the middle of pandemic as well. And right. Then we had to do the rest of it remotely.
Well, dude, like I said, I'm a big fan of your work. I'm glad we got to connect. And
big fan of yours.
Thank you. And like I said, anybody that there's a reason why it's top three, top 10, whatever it is. This is a really great documentary that, once again, it's not just about David Berkowitz or the Son of Sam. I just love the whole pop culture element of just seeing New York City in the 70s. And there's a great point, too, where one of the cops comes on and says, 81, everyone's talking about Studio 54. He goes, every club was like this. Everybody was doing coke. Everybody was having sex in the bathroom. It's like, that's a fun time.
It's true. That's, you know, it was written on the back of the one, on one of the envelopes. It's called Absolute Depravity. And yeah. That was really what was going on in New York City at the time. Like, shit was real.
Well, you nailed it, dude. And I appreciate it. And congratulations.
Thanks, Chris. Take care, buddy.
Thanks, dude.